OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 147 of Sign Language. I know it's been a bit of an extended break, and I've failed again in my mission to get an episode of this podcast out every fortnight, as was my plan. My excuse for the last 3 weeks, at least, has been that I was on holidays and out of the country. Kath, Max, and I went back to Borneo. I don't know if you recall, but a couple of years ago, we went to Borneo for 14 days, did an organized tour of 10 days within that 14-day period, absolutely loved the place, but could not go to the East Coast because of some political strife that was going on at the time. And so we decided that we loved the place so much, we were definitely going back, and this year we got to go back. Now, you're probably wondering, what's any of that got to do with an audio-related podcast? Well, I chose to take along with me, if you know me, you know my camera goes everywhere with me, but I also took along with me my trusty little Tascam DR05 handheld flash recorder. Wasn't exactly sure what I would use it for or whether I would even use it. I kind of imagined that I might on occasion put the video camera on a tripod and have it a fair distance away from Max, Kath and I. And I would have the flash recorder close to us so that we could, capture our audio up close on the flash recorder, and I could then post sync that with the video later on. So that was kind of in the back of my mind as one reason for taking it along. But I also thought, who's to say, I might come across something really interesting that I just want to record the audio of. And as luck would have it, such an event occurred. With no further preamble, I'll just cut to the piece that I recorded. I'll play it to you, and then afterwards I'll follow up. Here we go. Oh, and just a word of warning. The dialogue I recorded in the cave, which you're about to hear, was really low level, so I had to boost it with a couple of peak limiters. So the sound that I really want you to hear, which is at the end of the following piece, I'm not going to put through the peak limiter, so its level is going to be substantially lower compared to my voice, and so I will leave a sizable gap so that you can turn your volume up to hear it and then turn it down before I come back. Okay, here we go. Now, you might remember on a previous episode I spoke about the cave in Vietnam, which was the largest cave in the world, and I was hypothesizing about what the acoustics might sound like. Well, I'm now standing inside a cave in Borneo, which used to hold the record as the largest cave in the world and has now been relegated to second place. So I'm going to give you an impulse. This is what it sounds like. Okay, so the cave I was in was a cave called Deer Cave. Deer as in the four-legged fauna, Bambi, that kind of deer. And it's in Mulu National Park. Oh, sorry, the correct name is Gunung Mulu National Park. And it's sort of right in the middle of Borneo, just to the east of the Sultanate of Brunei. And we had gone to Mulu National Park. We were there for 3 or 4 nights, and in the time that we were there, we did a couple of different caves. Actually, I think we did 4 caves all up. We did 2 tours of 2 caves each. And Deer Cave, as I mentioned, it actually was at one stage the largest cave in the world. And I think the only reason it lost that title to the cave in Vietnam was because there had been a cave-in, if you like, of one section of the roof deep into the cavern. And that sort of essentially made the cave a smaller cave because it no longer went as far underground as it used to. So what really intrigued me is I was walking through this cave, and just to give you an idea, I will put a photo up in the show notes, which I shot in sort of in the entrance of Deer Cave looking into the main cavern. And I will put up a fairly high-res version of it, so you can go to the show notes, click on the photo, and if you look really closely, down sort of in the lower third of the image and fairly much dead center, you'll see two little white specks. They are people, right? And this only makes sense once you're actually looking at the photo, of course. That will give you a sense of the scale, of the size of this cavern. This cavern from floor to ceiling was over 100 meters high. This is an enclosed space. It was pretty epic. Width, it was probably about, I guess, 70 or 80 meters wide at the place that I was standing at when I clapped my hands. And yeah, I was just intrigued by it. Now, if you're wondering about the funny screeching noise in the background, that is the sound of a couple of 100,000 bats that live in the cave. So that noise never stops. There's pretty much nothing you can do about it. You just have to tolerate it. And the floor is absolutely covered in bat poo. The smell of ammonia is absolutely rank. I wasn't that put off by it, but it is quite a strong smell. And as Kath and I were walking along the boardwalk, and if you look in that photo, you can see the boardwalk. And from where those two people are in that photo, you can see that further off in the background, the boardwalk kind of goes from the right side off to the left into the distance. And I was sort of halfway along that section of the boardwalk when I recorded that impulse. Now, when I say an impulse, I didn't intend for anybody to actually use it as a reverb impulse, but if you want to, hey, knock yourself out. You might want to do a bit of noise reduction on the bats. That's entirely up to you. But what I thought was really interesting was just the nature of that impulse. If you, you know, open it up in an audio editor, you can see that there is a very definite first reflection, which happens at about, I think I measured it at about 175 milliseconds, which is obviously just the first slap off the, you know, off one side of the cavern. And then it sort of just blossoms into this gorgeous, lush reverb. But what I thought was equally interesting was at about the 750 millisecond mark, there's kind of this little surge in the reverb, like the whole reverb wash has travelled across the width of the cavern and hit the wall on the other side and then come back to you. So I guess, hey, you know, using C equals F lambda, you could calculate the actual width of the cavern based on the time that it took for that sort of swell in the reverb bouncing back from the other side of the cavern. So anyway, I was just intrigued by that. I thought that was something interesting and worthy of just, you know, sharing with you. I have not yet been to Vietnam, but as luck would have it, it is on our radar for 2017. Kath and I have this idea. We do an international holiday 1 year and a domestic holiday the next. So next year, 2016, will be a domestic holiday, and then 2017 we're aiming for Vietnam. So who knows, we may even make it to the name of that cave I don't recall right off the top of my head, but we might get there in 2 years' time. And if I do, I shall make sure I take my recorder with me on that trip, and if we do get to that cave, I'll record an impulse there as well. So yeah, I thought that might be of some interest to some of you. Now, also, while we were in Gunung Mulu National Park, we did a two-hour night walk. And this was a guided tour with a local, young kid called Sukia. And this guy was just freaky, right? We're walking along pitch black, right? This started at 7:30 at night, so it was you know, black by that stage. And we left the area where our accommodation was, were wooden boardwalks, and we're walking along these wooden boardwalks, and we've all got either a handheld torch or a head, you know, lantern, you know, the sort that you strap around your head. And this guy, he just walks along, he's got his handheld torch and he's just swinging it all around the place. And then all of a sudden he'll just stop and go, oh, here's a such and such. And he'd point out some tiny little insect. And he just like How the hell did you see that, dude? That is amazing. And as we were walking along, there was this sound, like, you got to imagine, right? You're walking through rainforest that scientists estimate that the rainforest in Borneo are around about 175 million years old, right? Nothing has ever been, you know, farmed like in this area. There's never been agriculture. Everything that has ever grown has grown wild, died wild, rotted, and been replaced with other things. So the, you know, the biodiversity in this rainforest is just phenomenal. And I've got it playing in the background so that you can hear it. And amongst all of the crickets and the things that I'm used to hearing was this funny sound. And it you can hear it, right? It's just this sort of whoop, whoop, kind of weird kind of thing. And I hadn't had a chance to say, "Hey, Sakia, what's that sound?" When all of a sudden he stops, shines his torch into the tree and goes, "Oh, here's this insect." And he probably did tell us what it was called. I didn't catch the name of it. And I have actually sent off an email asking someone from the national park to get back to me and tell me what that insect is called. And if that email response comes back to me before I post this podcast, I will include it in the show notes. But essentially, this thing looked like a butterfly. And it was not particularly big. You know, its wings were, you know, a couple of inches long, inch and a half wide, and they were camouflaged. They were bright green. They looked like a leaf. And the only reason that you could make out this creature was because of the fact that its wings were moving. And as you can hear from that sound, the wings are kind of, you know, they fold up from, like, laying out flat the way a moth does. They would come up and meet at the top in the middle, you know, over its body. And in the process of those wings coming up, you got this sound. And what I thought was really intriguing about that sound was the fact that while the wings are moving up and down, you know, over a, I don't know, 1-2 second period, they are also vibrating at a little over 500 hertz as well. It's crazy. So their wings are vibrating essentially on two fundamental frequencies simultaneously, right? It's got this high-speed thing that's, you know, creating that tone, and then the slow opening and closing of the wings is creating, for want of a better description, the, you know, attack, sustain, decay, release envelope of the sound, which I thought was amazing. And more amazing than that was the fact that you could hear these things for hundreds of meters through the rainforest. And yet it was this tiny little thing, you know, a couple of inches high with, you know, these soft wings, and it could create this much noise. It was amazing. Now, I realize that, you know, it is kind of low in the surrounding ambience of the rainforest, like all the crickets and all the other things that you can hear are equally loud, but that sound just kind of cuts through, and it's really obvious when you're walking through the rainforest. You can just hear them everywhere. So that really intrigued me. And I just wanted to share it because I thought it was really interesting the way nature creates, you know, all these different animals, and that it could, you know, have its wings fluctuating on two frequencies at once. I thought that was cool. So, yeah, something a bit different. Now, I do have a couple of other things that I wanted to include in this episode. One was something that popped up on the isotope.com blog probably 5 or 6 weeks ago now. I know it popped up before I went off on holiday. And this was tips and tutorials mastering for compressed audio formats. To be honest, I haven't even had a chance yet to go and have a look at the post on the blog. I just saw it come up in, I think it actually came up on Facebook because I've liked Isotope on Facebook. And I just sort of grabbed the link, sent it home to myself to go, yeah, I really need to have a look at this. Haven't yet had a chance to do that. But I thought it was a great topic of conversation, and I will be having a look at this here blog post. What is mastering? What do MP3 and AAC do to your audio? A couple of embedded SoundCloud files, some pro tips, mastering for iTunes, mastering for SoundCloud, mastering for YouTube. Yeah, this looks like a good read. So if that's of any interest to any of you, have a read. I promise I will do the same thing over the next week or two. Keen to hear your thoughts on it, and if I, you know, glean anything of information-wise that intrigues me or I find interesting in any way, I'll share that with you on the next episode. So that was one thing that I had. The next thing was Carol Weiss reached out to me on Facebook, clearly missing an episode of Sign Language. He said, "Hi, Bruce. Hope you had a nice holiday with your family. I have one question. I don't know if it may be something to talk about on your podcast. I do voiceover work for different projects, and usually they tell me how loud they need it, as peak minus 3 dBFS or so, and the format, usually 44.116 or something like that. But my last project, my client wanted this spec, HD audio level requirements. The loudness level of the program material must be in agreement with EBU R128/2014 directive, including the following delivery specifications. Reference level, 1K at minus 18 dB full scale. Integrated loudness program, minus 23 LUFS. Target level tolerance, plus or minus a half LUFS. Maximum true peak, minus 1 dB TP. Maximum momentary, no limitation. Maximum short-term momentary, 3 seconds, no limitations. Loudness range, no limitations. Codec, integer, little endian, PCM, sample rate 48K, sample size 24-bit, channels stereo. I opened the Waves Analyzer and selected the EBU R128 setup, but I wasn't sure what I was doing. My question is, if you can explain some of the specifications and how to achieve them, or is it a combination of loudness, compression, and limiting, or just limiting, or something else? I hope this is not a stupid question. Sorry if there's any grammar problems. Thanks for your time. If you're busy, can't answer, that's fine. I understand. Thanks, Carol."
Ah, Carol. Love questions like that, mate. Something technical we can get our teeth into. Okay, we'll start at the top. Reference level, 1K at minus 18 dBFS. Okay, dBFS is decibels full scale. It refers to the digital realm only. It does not have any relevance in the analog world. What we hopefully all of you are now familiar with is the idea that in the analog world we would mix and master to 0 dB VU, which was the point at which analog tape gave you the best signal to noise response. You could drive your tape a little bit harder, you know, to, you know, maybe plus 3, plus 4 dB. It varied depending on the tape formulation. And the harder you drove your signal, you know, beyond 0 VU, the more the signal would saturate, but in a very pleasing way. Digital, on the other hand, is no such beast. Once you hit 0 decibels full scale, your signal becomes clipped and just essentially reconstructs as a square wave and is very nasty on the ear. So the idea of a reference level was that in the analog days when we would mix stuff down to a quarter inch two-track tape, that tape would quite often be sent to some other, you know, radio station or production house or whatever. And every tape machine was calibrated differently. And tape, depending on whether it was new or old tape, would have a different record response and a different playback response. So the idea was, when you were ready to mix down from your analog tape, you know, from your multitrack to your quarter inch reel-to-reel, what you would do is you would set your record levels to the unity marks on the you know, record level controls on your two-track tape machine, so that the tone appeared to be hitting the tape at 0 VU, right? And the idea was that when that tape got to, you know, whatever studio it was going to, the engineer in that studio would put that tape up on his tape deck and press play. And let's say, for example, the left channel might have played back at, you know, plus 0.5 of a dB, and the right channel might have played back at minus 2 dB. And so what the engineer would do then was calibrate his playback levels off his tape machine. So he'd wind his left channel down by half a dB, and he'd wind his right channel up by 2 dB, so that his tone was coming off tape and hitting his analog desk at 0 VU, equally on both channels. And that would be his indication that everything else that was coming on the tape afterwards would likewise hit 0 dB VU, you know, plus or minus a little bit. So that was the idea behind a reference level. So what they've asked you for is minus 18 dB full scale, 1K tone. So you would use a tone generator to generate a 1 kilohertz, that is 1,000 cycles per second, tone, right? It's just a steady state tone. There's no harmonic content. It's just pure sine wave. At 1 kilohertz, at a peak level of minus 18 dB FS, right? So the idea is that you would put that down at the beginning of the WAV file that you are exporting for them, and you would not put any, you know, compression or peak limiting on that reference tone, because that reference tone is meant to be at a true peak of minus 18 dB full scale. Now, the reason for minus 18 is because that will fairly closely match up to 0 dB VU if it's played out of a digital to analog converter and into an analog system, assuming a few other criteria are met. So that was that's the idea behind that reference level. It tends to suggest that maybe they're either really old school and just haven't adapted to the times, or they are genuinely going to play your WAV file out into some sort of analog system and capture through some other system rather than just importing your WAV file. Why they would do that in this day and age, I don't know, but hey, that's what they've asked for. That's what you got to give them. Okay, next one. Integrated loudness program, minus 23 LUFS. LUFS is loudness units full scale. It is also sometimes referred to as LKFS, which is loudness K-weighted full scale. K-weighted comes from Bob Katz, the mastering engineer who came up with the idea of the K-weighting. Essentially, it's a variation on the Fletcher-Munson equal loudness contour curves that we, you know, well, there's a whole science behind how we perceive loudness at different frequencies. The human auditory system is most attuned to sort of those, you know, mid-range frequencies from like, you know, 1K to 8K, which is where the majority of human speech falls in the spectrum. Really low frequencies and really high frequencies, we tend to be less attuned to. We hear them, but we're not as receptive to them as we are to those mid-range tones. And so the Fletcher-Munson curves reflect that bias on the part of the human auditory system. Bob Katz's K-weighting monitoring and levels integrate that bias so that frequencies which are sort of down at the lower end or up high are allowed to be louder than the stuff in that sort of 1K to 8K range where we are most sensitive. Those signals need to be lower in level so as to give an overall balanced impression of loudness. So an integrated loudness program, what they're referring to there is when you pull up a plugin in any DAW which does LUFS or LKFS metering, you will see that there is a short-term integrated loudness and a long-term integrated loudness. Essentially, that second spec, integrated loudness program, is your long-term integrated loudness. And what they want to see over the long term, and in this instance, like long term means long term, right? Like 15 seconds. It's like a moving average. I don't know if any of you follow the stock market. If you know what a moving average is on a graph, you know, you might have a 150-day moving average of stocks where, you know, the stocks that what the stock price did 151 days ago falls off the end of the graph, and what the stock price did today gets added to the front end of the graph, and the average of all those prices over 150 days becomes your moving average for today, right? And that moving average changes, but it changes very slowly because it's 150-day moving average. It's exactly the same with this. Because it uses a long-term average of the loudness of the signal, that value in your plugin won't change particularly quickly. So over the long term, it will remain relatively constant. If signal increases by a significant amount, you know, 20 seconds into your program, then over the next, you know, 10 seconds or so after that swell in content, you'll slowly see the long-term integrated loudness start to creep up as, you know, that louder signal is added to the, you know, the quieter level signal that came before it, and the average is slowly increasing. So they want an average long-term loudness of minus 23 LUFS. Okay, third spec, target level tolerance, plus or minus 0.5 LUFS. Now, if I read this correctly, what they're essentially saying is that the long-term loudness for your voice track must never go louder than minus 22.5 and never go softer than minus 23.5, which I've got to say, that seems a little draconian, a little extreme. You know, for a voice track, I would have considered a voice track to be a production element, not a final. I mean, maybe it is final. Maybe they absolutely want you to master the audio so that they don't have to do another thing to it. That's the only thing that I can assume. But a 1 dB tolerance long term, that seems fairly, shall we say, heavy-handed. It doesn't allow for much dynamic in the delivery of your voice track. Not sure why they would want it to be that tight, but hey, that's my interpretation, unless I'm misinterpreting what that target level tolerance is. But that's what it seems like to me. Maximum true peak, minus 1 dB TP. Now, I've never encountered TP, but my understanding is that it's the same as full scale. So minus 1 dB TP is the same as minus 1 dB FS. That's to the best of my knowledge. If anyone knows that to be incorrect, please let me know. But that's my understanding. Maximum momentary, no limitation. I actually find that to be erroneous because they've just specified that the maximum true peak mustn't be any greater than minus 1 dB full scale, or in their terminology, true peak. So I would have said maximum momentary is also minus 1 dB full scale or true peak. Because essentially the momentary loudness is, you know, things like the sharp transient, you know, when I clapped my hands in the cave, right? I mean, that's what you call a short term, you know, momentary spike, right? That can be much louder than all of the surrounding voiceover because it is so short, right? And it's not going to upset the long-term momentary loudness on your meter. But it still has to respect the true peak of minus 1 dB. Maximum short-term momentary based on a 3-second moving average. So that's kind of halfway in between. You know, it's slower than a peak program meter. It's slower than a VU meter, but it's considerably faster than the long-term integrated loudness. So it's based on 3 seconds of audio at any given point in time. And again, they've said no limitation, which, you know, to me, it's, again, it should be specifying minus 1 dB full scale. Loudness range, no limitations. I'm not 100% certain what they mean by that one, Carol. My apologies. Anyone who's listening who works with this stuff on a day-to-day basis, Steve Hope, I'm looking at you. Please sing out if you've got anything to add on that, what the loudness range refers to. And then you've just got your codec stuff, integer, little endian. That refers to the way the words, the digital word length is written into the file. I can't remember if little endian refers to the left-hand integer being the least significant or the most significant, or if it's the right-hand sample being least, but yeah, it's one or the other, and it really doesn't matter a great deal to the way the file works, just as long as you get it right when you save the file, because obviously that's what they want. Whatever system they're putting this audio into requires little endian. I'm not sure which piece of software you're using, whether you're using Reaper, whether you're using Audition, Pro Tools, something different. Have a look in your... When you go Save As and you select your file type, look for your Options button or, you know, a Settings button that allows you to choose the type of WAV file you're saving. And hopefully you can find something there that tells you about little endian and big endian. Just make sure you choose little endian and they'll be happy. PCM sample rate, obviously 48K. That's fairly simple. They want 48,000 samples per second. Sample size, 24-bit. That's your bit resolution. Assuming you have recorded your voice track at 24-bit, you won't need to apply any dither because you're not reducing the word length. And channels, stereo. Why they want stereo, I don't know. It really is starting to look like they want to drop your voice track straight onto the master without having to touch it. They're obviously not planning on doing any further processing to the voice track. That's my take based on what I've just read. So Carol, I hope that's helped in terms of an explanation of what all those things are. How you achieve it? Yeah. Basically, what you are going to want is the very final plugin in your chain will need to be a peak limiter set with an output limit of minus 1 dB full scale. And really, you shouldn't have any threshold on that because it's really just there to catch any peaks that happen to, you know, prior to that plugin exceed minus 1 dB full scale. And then that plugin will catch them, limit them to minus one, and your file will be good. As for achieving your long-term integrated loudness of minus 23 LUFS, that's just going to require some compression and, you know, maybe it, well, you no, you don't need another peak limiter, just a compressor, really. But the idea of a half dB LUFS tolerance in either direction of minus 23, that just seems extreme. But hey, I don't know what the content is. You've said it's voiceover, but yeah. I guess you just need to go back to them and, if you're having trouble getting your compression to hold your voice track to that sort of momentary loudness, or sorry, long-term loudness, maybe you need to confer with them a little further. I don't know, maybe with the right compression, maybe you could get a long-term loudness to sit pretty still. I guess you've just got to make sure that your delivery of your voice is fairly consistent and not too extreme in the dynamics yeah, wow. All right, mate, I hope that's been of some value to you. I will put a link in the show notes for the Wikipedia article on LKFS, and I'm sure from there you can launch off in different directions if you need to read anything more about it. My apologies. I know it's been a few weeks since you first sent me that, and like I said, been out of the country, so that's why I haven't got to it sooner, and you've probably already dealt with it. I have a couple of other things, but I'll leave those for the next episode and try and build up some more stuff to include in that episode. In the meantime, any feedback on this app, please give me a holler, studio@audiotu.com. If you haven't already found me on Facebook, it's facebook.com/audiotu. If you're going to send me a friend request and I've never heard from you before, please tell me who you are. I find it really weird when I get these just friend requests from people. I got no idea of who they are. I don't know if they listen to this podcast, if they listen to Shutters Inc., or if they're just spammers. Or if you're going to send me a friend request, at least say, hey, I love your, sign language, or I hate sign language, but I listen anyway, or something like that. You can also find me on Twitter at AudioToU. I think that's about it. As I promised earlier, I will get around to reading that article on the isotope.com blog about mastering for compressed formats, because that sounds interesting. Okay, I think that will do it. Until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign language.
Another audiotu.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audiotu.com.